Ladies and gentlemen, before we go any further, I would just like to inform you that Scientology, Scientologist, Dianetics, and the name L. Ron Hubbard are registered trademarks owned exclusively by the Church of Scientology. Thank you. Now let's get on with the show.
Support for the Projection Booth podcast comes from Stitcher Smart Radio. Now podcast listeners can access the latest episodes of the Projection Booth and thousands of other podcasts on the go without downloading or syncing. Stitcher instantly delivers episodes of your favorite shows to your mobile phone. Stitcher Smart Radio can be found in the iPhone and Android app stores or on the web at stitcher.com/booth.
Destroy all monsters. Sticky figments. Sticky figments. I'm sick of them. Picture bits carried by cosmic rays. The strange case of the cosmic rays. Plutonium piles. Inside this pyramid. She's in a man-made mountain on the moon. Hollow moon. Some rays still penetrate this deep. So many picture stories. All of them are true. Read them in the rocks like a crystal ball. Moving images and voices too. Bad memories and worse fantasies. Bad copies of bad men stuck in the muck. Tainted and tangled and mangled the memory banks. Bunched and bundled, burnt into my brain. Branded onto dead meat. This sick puppet has been attacked, attached to. In nerves, there are narratives. But there is a way to slough them off, as there's a way to free that prison planet called Earth. Every day and every way, we are building a bridge to the white light. And so she toils to ground the colony, our picture processing station. We expunge the embeds and drop our doll bodies. Because L. Ron's got the tech. L. Ron Hubbard's got the tech.
We welcome you as a new servant of the glorious planet. We have implanted our life in your brain, and you are now a slave. We'll do what we tell you.
Welcome to the Projection Booth. I'm your host, Mike White. Joining me is Mr. L. Rob St. Mary.
Man, I'm so clear. I'm Crystal Pepsi.
Zima, Xenu, you be the judge. Get out your e-meters and get your Thetans in gear. This is the first of two episodes we're going to be doing related to Scientology on film. This week, we're looking at Craig Baldwin's 2008 film Mock-Up on Mu, which centers on the unusual relationships between rocket scientist and occultist Jack Parsons, Scarlet Woman Marjorie Cameron, mystic Aleister Crowley, pulp writer L. Ron Hubbard, and aerospace firm Lockheed Martin. Now, if you've not seen the work of Craig Baldwin before, it's not your typical narrative filmmaking. Let's talk about how the story is told as we talk more about what the story of the film is. So, Rob, was this your first rodeo with Baldwin's work?
Yeah, that's right. It was great to see it. I mean, there had been some discussions earlier between me and you and doing some of other Craig Baldwin's work, but this one kind of came up kind of through a side channel. You know, as we've talked about before, I don't read a lot. It's not that I don't like reading books. It's just I take an entirely long time to read. So how this episode came together was I was reading Going Clear, the Lawrence Wright book about Scientology, and it was so much interest in that book when I was so interesting to read that book and all of these connections between things that I had already knew, but I just didn't know about L. Ron Hubbard's connection to Jack Parsons, to Aleister Crowley, to all of this like occult stuff that was going on post-World War II and even before, and just sort of made it really fascinating to me. So I, also being a complete strangio, you know, going, you know what, when I go to LA, one of the funnest things to do is to go to the big Scientology office and take all the tests.
We're doing free personality tests today.
What do I have to do?
Have you heard of Scientology? It's all based on the book Dianetics. A lot of really cool people are Scientologists, like Tom Cruise and John Travolta. Why don't you come on in and we'll get your fun free personality test started.
And do the museum tour. I know, it's crazy. And as Mr. Bill Byforce would say,
you're like a walking Lynch film and it makes me angry.
It was just all of this sort of like a mix of stuff. We wanted to talk about Craig Baldwin and highlight his work because he does great work. And just all this conversation that we were having sort of off the show related to L. Ron Hubbard and all of this occult stuff. And in this book, which I can't recommend enough, Going Clear by Lawrence Wright. So if you haven't had a chance to read it, I would definitely say pick that up.
Yeah, Wright was really doing the NPR tour for a while. It was like every show I was listening to, there was an interview with him. And yeah, absolutely fascinating stuff. And then my relationship with that material was kind of coming through Baldwin stuff. Makabamu, I saw that a few years ago at the Maryland Film Festival, and that was terrific. What was even better was that Baldwin was there introducing the film and doing a Q&A afterwards. And if you've not heard Baldwin speak, he is completely charismatic and just so into his craft. It is really great to hear him talk about stuff. The first time I think I ran into Baldwin's work was actually at your old stomping grounds, Rob, at Thomas Video. They had that kind of back corner, the cult corner, I guess it was, and they had Tribulation 99, and I remember reading about that, I think way back in like Film Threat or someplace, maybe Film Threat Video Guide, and picked that up. And Tribulation 99 is like this great 45-minute kind of mind kind of thing where you just... It really is very hypnotic almost, and just you kind of get drawn into it. And yeah, it's just amazing stuff. So, but I was unaware too until I saw this movie, even who Jack Parsons was, which is kind of crazy because Jack Parsons, I mean, you could call him kind of like the father of modern rocketry. And he's kind of been swept under the rug by history a little bit.
And I think a lot of that has to do with his whole occult background. I mean, if there's one thing that scientists don't like is mysticism, especially really strong scientists. I mean, people who are in the physical fields, you find that when they do surveys of scientists, they're usually, you know, agnostics or atheists. They don't have a lot of time for mysticism. And Parsons was definitely involved in a lot of that. My introduction to Parsons actually came through two sources in my youth. When I was about 17, 18 years old, I read basically everything I could get my hands on related to Anton LaVey. And I've always had an interest in occult and, you know, belief systems and why people believe what they believe. I'm not a believer, but I just find it fascinating, sort of how people come to their stuff. And LaVey wrote about Parsons, and then through LaVey, also because of the connection with Kenneth Anger, he also talks about Parsons. So there's this whole kind of contingent, and when you talk about Kenneth Anger, he also was connected into Crowley and OTO and all that stuff that was going on at the time. And Marjorie Cameron also has a piece. She's an actress in one of Kenneth Anger's films. So there's all of this connection between all this stuff. And then to find out, like I said, in reading Going Clear, that L. Ron Hubbard was involved in some way through this because he met Parsons, I believe, according to the book, through Robert Heinlein. There's all of this science fiction aspect to it as well. So it's really fascinating. And I know from your background and being someone who's interested in pulp novels and science fiction, had you read any of L. Ron Hubbard's works, not talking about Dianetics, which I picked up a used copy for 50 cents somewhere and read years ago, but talking about his pulp writing, his science fiction writing?
Strangely enough, no. Of all of the writers that I've read, I've never read his stuff. I've read a lot of Heinlein's, and I remember hearing years and years ago that Scientology was like a bar bet between Heinlein and L. Ron Hubbard. But yeah, I've never really picked up any of his stuff. But I did read Battlefield Earth recently, and I know we'll be talking about that a lot more in our next episode. And if you guys want to hear more about Kenneth Anger, you can go back to our Kenneth Anger episode that we did gosh, probably about a year or so ago, which was interesting to me because I had never really experienced any of Anger's films either. So, or Angers, as some people would pronounce his last name. So, yeah, I really just was kind of out of it. And then it's fascinating, this whole crux of science fiction, science, occultism. I mean, at the time, I mean, you've got Los Angeles in the 50s, 40s. Before that, it was this weird, like, crucible of all of these, like, kind of fringe thinking that was all going on. And at the time, I mean, rocketry was the stuff of science fiction. There were, you know, scientific facts, and I put those in air quotes, that you could not ever get to the moon, that you could not leave the atmosphere, that you could not maintain so much thrust for so much time. And so all of these things were all relegated to these kind of, like, you know, kooks almost, you know, like, oh, why are you into science fiction? That's so, you know, juvenile and, you know, Buck Rogers and all this kind of stuff. And just they would put this kind of cast on it. And, you know, same thing with, like, why are you into this occult stuff that's so juvenile? And why are you into rocketry that is just, you know, the stuff of dreams? You know, all of this stuff was just kind of, you know, off to the side, fringe kind of stuff. And Parsons was into all of it. He was into science fiction, into the rocketry, into the occult. And it's interesting that it all kind of comes together, and all comes together in Los Angeles, it feels like, all at that one particular time.
I want to quote a couple of parts out of the Going Clear book that I think will kind of illustrate this stuff and to kind of talk about it. I mean, got to understand that, you know, and I think it's still that way. When we look to California, we go, oh, that's the place to, you know, people are into all kinds of weird stuff out there, you know, compared to us Midwestern folks, you know, in the way we were growing up. So there's a piece that Lawrence Wright has in Going Clear. It says, Southern California was filled with migrants who weren't tied to old creeds and ready to experiment with new ways of thinking. The region had been swarming with theosophists and Zoroastrians and swamis and mystics and gurus of different faiths, and pulled in acolytes into their orb. And he says, the most brilliant member of this galaxy of occultists was John Whiteside Parsons, known as Jack, a rocket scientist working on what would later become the Jet Propulsion Laboratory at California Technical Institute. Parsons also has a crater on the moon named after him and developed solid rocket fuel. Darkly handsome and brawny, later called by some scholars the James Dean of the occult, Parsons was a science fiction fan and outspoken advocate of free love who had acquired a three-story craftsman-style mansion with a 12-car garage on South Orange Avenue in Pasadena, a sedate palm-lined street also known as Millionaire's Row. The house had belonged to Arthur H. Fleming, who was a logging tycoon and philanthropist, and had hosted President Theodore Roosevelt and even Albert Einstein at one time. The street had also had a home by William Wrigley of the chewing gum fortune, and the beer baron Adolph Busch and his widow lived next door to Parsons. Now, this is good. Said that she must have been appalled to watch Parsons divide the historic home and coach house into 19 apartments and then advertise for renters. He sought artists, anarchists, musicians, the more bohemian the better. Must not believe in God, the ad stated. Among those passing through the parsonage were aging actresses from the silent era, opera singers, several astrologers, an ex-convict, the chief engineer of the development of the atomic bomb, among the others. And it said that Parsons was known to throw parties that featured women in diaphanous gowns, as one visitor observed, that would dance around a pot of fire surrounded by coffins topped with candles. It said that he had, of course, opened up a branch of the OTO, which was Aleister Crowley's organization. And they had a giant portrait of Crowley that hung in the stairwell. It said, despite these bizarre atmospheres that he cultivated, Parsons took his involvement in OTO seriously and made brazen ethical claims of his own movements, claims that would later sound familiar as Scientology rose a few years later. And the reason being was that at this time, L. Ron Hubbard eventually moved in to this bohemian group and started to become involved in the various rituals and things as written about, according to Lawrence Wright and others.
I'm thinking maybe we should kind of take our break now, and play back the interview that we did with Adam Parfrey of Feral House about a book on Parsons, Sex and Rockets, which kind of we're all leading to Mock Up on Moo. We're introducing the pieces here that will help explain this movie a little bit more as we go along.
This is Adam Parfrey. I'm publisher, editor, and sometimes writer for Feral House Press and also Process Media. It's another separate publishing company. And work out of the state of Washington and the Port Townsend area up there. And we've been in business since the late 80s with Feral House. Previous publishing company, I collaborated with a guy named Ken Sweezy with what's called Amok Press. And we did about 8 titles with that firm. And so it's been going on for a while now for me.
When someone asks you about Feral House and sort of what the stuff that you're interested in putting out, how do you sort of explain it? Because it is an interesting catalog.
It's all nonfiction, what we're interested in doing. But it really is a broad range of nonfiction titles. They go from titles that investigate occult, investigate political conspiracies, also pop culture things that hadn't been adequately researched before. But sometimes when we put out a book, that will inspire others to put out books along the same lines. And it's kind of amazing how that comes about, that there's a little pop culture fad after Feral House publishes a book on the subject.
That sort of seems to be the case with the one book I wanted to talk about, with the Jack Parsons book, Sex and Rockets. I mean, I think you guys were probably the first to do it, and then I've seen that there are other places where his story seems to pop up from time to time. Can you give me some background into how this book got onto your radar and eventually you decided to put it out?
The book got on my radar because when I first heard about Jack Parsons, I think it was through Robert Anton Wilson. And Robert Anton Wilson wrote about Jack Parsons' story in a book he did called Cosmic Trigger. I think that was published in the earlier mid-80s. I was always interested in the story, so I found somebody who knew more about it. He was involved with the OTO or Crowley's cult or sect, I should say. And he wrote a piece about Parsons for Apocalypse Culture. And then as time went on, the 90s and so on, in the late 90s, I came across this guy who shall remain nameless because he doesn't want to put his actual name onto it. But I saw a pamphlet he wrote about Jack Parsons, and I got in touch with him, and I asked him to expand his pamphlet into a book. I brought him out to the L.A. area to track down a lot of stuff that can only be found out there for Jet Propulsion Laboratories and other institutions that Parsons worked for. And so we had both the occult life, the occult story, and then there's the scientific research story. That's funny because when you put the book out, people from one side or the other can't understand the joining of those two things, the mystical world and the scientific world. And that's what really fascinates me about Parsons.
It's such a time of wonder, and that seems to be captured very well as far as, you know, rocketry being such a new science and kind of a joke, and then, you know, spiritualism and all that, and joining of the two was just an absolute, it is a slightly bizarre concept for us, but back then it seems like it might have gone together a little bit better.
Well, I don't think it went together well back then either. As a matter of fact, rocketry, with the exception of Robert Goddard, the scientist who did these rocket tests, that was considered science fiction at that time. Now it's considered legitimate science, or has been since like the 50s, or right around the time that Jack Parsons died. But the sense of it back then, it was kiddie stuff. And it was pulp fiction. You know, I've got pulp magazines, and it was all like these sci-fi, mystical, weird stories, weird tales, that sort of thing. And that was what it was considered, just some bizarre fictional concept that only sci-fi, you know, Jules Verne stuff.
I know that Jack Carter wants to remain anonymous, or, you know, the artist going under the name Jack Carter wants to remain anonymous. What can you tell us about him, and why does he want to remain anonymous?
Jack Carter, that's a pseudonym, works for the U.S. government, and he thinks that his job will be threatened, or his wife feels that way, or both of them feel that way, and so he wants to keep his real name mum as a result.
We talk about Parsons and, you know, Jet Propulsion Laboratory and all the stuff he was doing on rockets. When we look at him, how important is he in the history of sort of America and development of the space program?
Extremely important, because without the solid fuel and the rocket tests they did on, you know, with his friend and on his own for all those years, they would not have had the rocket capable of going above the Earth's gravitational field. That you know, that was the object, and he did it satisfactorily. And then there was World War II stuff he used as well, like the JATO rockets, J-A-T-O, and, you know, things that worked in the Second World War for the Allies, which is funny because the enemy worked by Wernher von Braun at Peenemünde. I'm not sure exactly how you pronounce that, but the Nazi rocket labs and all that stuff. They eventually worked together in some way. No, not they weren't working in the same office, but Wernher von Braun, who came over through Operation Paperclip to assume some of the Nazi scientists into American soil and projects. Now, I read a Wernher von Braun biography where Wernher von Braun says, without Jack Parsons, we would not have had a rocket to the moon.
You referred to science fiction, pulp fiction, that kind of stuff, and just the way that Parsons was kind of in that realm and then moving more towards the real with his experiments and science. How do you see him kind of interacting with L. Ron Hubbard, a science fiction writer?
Parsons also hung out with people in L.A. They would meet at the Clifton's cafeteria downtown and with sci-fi writers. So he had an interest in science fiction per se, not as complete fantasy, but as repurposing reality or the conceptions of reality through fiction. And when he met Hubbard, Hubbard had a similar sense of things. And he got a lot from, apparently, the early days, Hubbard got a lot from Crowley's ideas and beliefs. And that's kind of like a so-called dark passage in L. Ron Hubbard's life, and that the Church of Scientology is not that keen on exploring those ideas. There was a similarity of purpose back then with Jack Parsons and L. Ron Hubbard, and Hubbard played himself up. He was no doubt building himself up and lying a bit about his career and his work and who he worked with and all that, because as he produced fictions about his own life as well as fictions about the world at large through his pulp constructs.
Hubbard and Parsons were friends, and Hubbard lived with him for a while and was part of the group that obviously was connected to Crowley. When you look at Scientology, can you trace it back to both Crowley and Parsons and his time with them?
Well, there's a new biography or a new nonfiction book that's very popular now that uses Sex and Rockets, a book we published, as source material on that particular subject. And there are other books about L. Ron Hubbard that has that information. It's no big secret these days that L. Ron Hubbard was influenced by Crowley, and Parsons, of course, very influenced by Crowley. And so it's a fascinating aspect of our society that huge influential realms of the world were influenced by this guy known as a black magician, per se.
I don't know if it's necessarily common knowledge, but it's definitely getting out there more, the idea of this whole connection between these individuals. What was the reaction when Sex and Rockets came out?
Well, there were feature articles written by it or influenced by it, and it got out there, had some influence, I guess. There were kind of copycat books then coming out afterward. But what happened initially is that I was being stalked, basically, by people from the Church of Scientology, and I had to figure out what to do about that and how to deal with that situation. And then another fact is that even if you look on Amazon customer comments about it, that the Sex and Rockets book, you'll see that scientists or people who are science-oriented can't believe or don't understand the occult aspect of it at all and think it's all bullshit. And so I got a lot of reactivity about that. In the past, before Sex and Rockets came out, there was a lot of stories or some stories about Jack Parsons that had no basis in fact, really. That's why we did the Sex and Rockets to begin with, to tell the true story about it, to find all verifiable data possible. And because it's such a fantastic story, there's been a lot of lies told about it, and it's been restructured by people as a kind of a fiction. And so what's real, what's not, what happened, what didn't? That was my original goal by doing this book.
You talked about having some problems after the book came out with people stalking you. Are things better now? Has it cooled off? Or
I figured out the way to handle that with the Church of Scientology. I told them, you know, I wrote them letters and talked to them that said, we're not doing a book about L. Ron Hubbard, but this book involves L. Ron Hubbard. If it doesn't involve L. Ron Hubbard, people will know it's a lie or a lying book that doesn't have the facts. So we need to have the facts. This is not about the Church of Scientology. This doesn't focus, plainly focus on L. Ron Hubbard, but he's certainly a major character in it. I said, I would like to hear from the Church of Scientology, and I will print it in the book, The Church of Scientology's Perspective on L. Ron Hubbard and Jack Parsons. And so eventually they sent me some things that they would like to have in the book, and I did include them as footnotes. So I did, I was clear about what the intention was of the book. I was clear that it would not look good to them to remove material about L. Ron Hubbard there. I said that they're all verified facts that's vetted, and I did get it vetted. And so if they sued, it would not work for them. I found the data they provided or the ideas they provided about L. Ron Hubbard to be very interesting or intriguing, because it makes L. Ron Hubbard into a creepier character, I think, than if he was just simply a con man, you know. So he's both a con man, but a con man who worked for the U.S. government to destroy people. That's what they said. He's working for naval intelligence. There's no naval records about that because they destroyed it because they didn't want to. The American government wanted to cover up L. Ron Hubbard's work for them.
That seems like something so counterintuitive that they would want that out there.
Yeah, but they preferred that than to the simple con man story.
What's your take on Parsons' death?
Well, Parsons died in an explosion in his garage, and right around the time he was going to move to Mexico, and that's why he was, he was getting a trailer together to take his belongings down to Mexico with him and his wife, Cameron. It could have been a few things. One is that he got in a legal situation where he was an expert on explosives. And as a result of that, he got this evil LAPD detective sent to prison for quite some time. Right around the time he was killed by the explosive, that man got out of prison. That's one thing. Other people say the government showed that he was going against rules of his secrecy clearance and giving information about explosives to the new state of Israel. I'm not certain exactly what kind of information was passed on to the state of Israel, but apparently that it was information that when he was working for Howard Hughes, that he passed on that information. I'm not exactly certain what that information is exactly, but that's another aspect that might have led to his death in some way or another. Another reason that might have led to his death is that he was, Jack Parsons wasn't fearful of doing drugs, and he was doing heroin at that time. And, you know, though he handled these explosives for decades, he might have gotten uncautious about it, and the explosion might have happened to his, some mishap, didn't handle the explosives correctly. There are a few different reasons why he could have died. I think any of them are logical.
As for any follow-ups or additional materials that may be coming out related to the book, or is Sex and Rockets, as you see it right now, everything that can and should be said about Jack Parsons?
Not at all. I think there could be more information that comes up, explored, like that explosive situation. I spoke to a guy, and I put it in the book, and the occult people didn't like it, but it's a real story and pertinent to Jack Parsons, and I personally love Jack Parsons. I think he's a great guy. So I don't have anything. I'm not trying to explore these ideas that he's a really creepy dude or anything like that. But there was a guy who worked at a bookstore, a science bookstore, a technical bookstore in downtown Los Angeles. And I spoke to this guy, he was an older guy, and he liked Jack Parsons. He knew Jack Parsons personally. And he also knew, and he was upset that Parsons died because he considered himself a friend. But he told me this story about these detectives that came in that were exploring Parsons' death. They were LAPD detectives. And they said that in the explosion, they found these syringes with heroin in them near the explosion. They found these films of Parsons f***ing his mother and like incest films. But they also found films with him f***ing a dog. And so this is what the detectives were saying. Is that true? I don't know. But that was being passed around at that time. Now, if you explore Parsons' literature, he wrote pro-incest concepts in his literature, his own writings. So, and also, you know, he was also very pro-drug. So I don't see that as being not right for the Parsons story, but I'm not sure what he did or what was going on exactly or what caused his death or what he had around his house. But these are the stories of the time, and I was being clear by stating what was being discussed and what was supposedly being found by the police.
For those who are interested in the book, where's the best place to get it and then also find out the latest on what's going on with Feral House?
Sex and Rockets can be accessed probably best through Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com, or you can send for a catalog from us, or you can go to the Feral House website, which is Feral as a feral dog or feral child, feralhouse.com, and get it from us directly. And then you can get a catalog along with our other publications. You can also download our catalogs as an electronic file from our website.
thanks to Adam Parfrey for taking the time to talk to us. We have a link where you can get Sex and Rockets and learn more about Feral House, his book publishing company. You can get it at projection-booth.com. We're talking about Mock-Up on Moo this week, Craig Baldwin's film, and we're eventually going to get there. But there's several different steps that we want to get there before we get there so that you get an idea of what we're talking about, of all this interconnection between Jack Parsons, the occult, science fiction, science fact, L. Ron Hubbard, and what eventually became Scientology. Well, a few years ago, a filmmaker by the name of Peter N. Alexander directed a version of L. Ron Hubbard's life, which he calls The Prophet. Now, Prophet spelled P-R-O-F-I-T.
We'll post the link over to where you can see The Prophet online over at our website, projection-booth.com. You know, one of those illegal films that we enjoy talking about so much. So, Rob, what did you think about The Prophet?
I liked it. I thought it was pretty well done for a low-budget film. I understand that there may have been some issues related to the actual production of the film, some possible protests from Scientology once they found out what he was up to, and that may have led to some production issues. But I thought overall it was a pretty good story. It's a pretty straightforward story that I think basically you just change the names and you find in something like we talked about Going Clear, or to some extent what we would see just a few years ago with The Master from Paul Thomas Anderson. It has a lot of similar scenes, a lot of similar ideas in terms of how that all comes together.
How does it compare to Going Clear? What kind of similarities do you see? I mean, because I haven't read Going Clear yet. I pretty much just know about Hubbard through, you know, Wikipedia and other different sources and through this film. I mean, of course, this isn't directly his life story because this is about a guy named Leland Conrad Powers, not L. Ron Hubbard. So just to put that out there to be sure that we're just talking about this film and how it compares to this other guy, L. Ron Hubbard.
It's the same thing also with The Master, though, who was Lancaster Dodd. But when we talk about the comparisons between the two and also with Going Clear, I mean, it's a very straightforward story. I mean, you have someone within The Prophet where you have this Jack Parsons character who the lead character becomes friends with, and he gets involved with the occult aspect, and he's also, you know, writing science fiction and then eventually transitions to writing this sort of self-help book that is also related to medical issues where, you know, sort of mind over matter ideas. And he also asserts himself as a member of the military. Hubbard did have a military background, although there's some that let's say he didn't quite live up to what he had claimed in his own biographies. And the aspect of going out to sea and having, you know, the boat and all that stuff and building a lot of it based on his love of sailing and things like that and sort of the order and structure. I mean, within Scientology, things are called Sea Org, you know. And it's like, and a lot of the structure of people and the various titles they get are all based on this. A lot of stuff related to Hubbard and his love of the sea and being out there and being a captain on ship and stuff like that. So a lot of that stuff works its way in. Also, the various sort of ups and downs. The character in The Prophet also creates a sort of technological device similar to an e-meter, much the same in The Master as well. So I would say it's a pretty good straightforward biography where they basically kind of just strip out the names and change them. If you really want to get into the particulars and even get more into sort of the more of the gritty stuff, and especially the things that happen after Hubbard's death, that's the stuff that's really where Going Clear, the book, really fills it in, where it talks about sort of these rehabilitation camps that they had where they would take members who had, you know, affronted the organization or something and put them into like forced labor. And there's some people who have come out of there and said that they were abused and things like that and held basically captive. And then other things related to the current leadership within Scientology and also some of its connections to celebrity culture, be it John Travolta or Tom Cruise or things like that.
the thing about him being on the ship, and it's kind of fascinating, you're right, there is a lot of crossover between Scientology and naval stuff. There's of all the stuff that WikiLeaks kind of managed to get out into the ether, one of them is, they released several documents about Scientology, and there's a whole thing about structure, and yeah, all of those terms are right out of the Navy, so it's kind of weird. And yeah, the Commodore is L. Ron himself. Now, the thing about him being on the ship, wasn't that him kind of escaping taxation?
Well, he had, at several points in Lawrence Wright's book, Going Clear, had run afoul of the law in various places. For good or bad, they were kind of persecuted and not wanted in certain places. And within the book, there's discussion where L. Ron Hubbard wanted to set up basically sort of a commune or something, or a campus, like in North Africa, like somewhere near, like in Morocco or something. And he got sort of pushed off from there, and they wanted to go to the UK. They couldn't go there. It was like all these different places, like he would show up with the boat and they'd be like, nope, sorry, you can't dock here. And they would just sort of tool around all over the place. So they just kind of kept getting pushed from place to place. You know, another thing when we also talk about all the use of the ship metaphors, when we look at a lot of science fiction, Star Trek, big example, a lot of that is based on naval as well. It's just taking all of this naval language and saying, okay, well, if there was a ship and it was in space, they would probably use the same ideas, the same words in terms of captain and, you know, various starboard and, you know, port and all that stuff, you know, use all the same terminology. So it's not really that far out to consider that when he started his organization, although he was very much tied to the sea, he was also looking at the comparative to the stars as well.
Yeah, that's true. And we should probably point out that Nicholas Meyer, the guy who we interviewed for our Star Trek II episode, was the guy who kind of brought that naval thing really to the fore when it came to Star Trek II. And, you know, their uniforms, their terminology, the whole blowing of the little whistle when the superior officer is on the deck, all that kind of stuff, really. There was a little bit as far as the way that they used naval stuff in Star Trek before, but when it came to that, that really kind of brought it forward. And after that, it was, you know, every incarnation of Star Trek since then has been very naval influenced. The other thing that really got me when it came to the prophet was the whole idea of what I know of Scientology. I usually learn from Tom Cruise meltdowns. And one of those is the whole idea of the antipathy towards psychology.
Before I was a Scientologist, I never agreed with psychiatry. And then when I started studying the history of psychiatry, I started realizing more and more why I didn't agree with psychiatry. And I know that psychiatry is... this is pseudoscience. Here we are today, where I talk out against drugs and psychiatric abuses of electric shocking people, okay, against their will, of drugging children with them not knowing the effects of these drugs. Do you know what Adderall is? Do you know Ritalin? Do you know now that Ritalin is a street drug? Do you understand that? And Matt, I'm asking you a question.
I understand there's abuse of all of these things.
No, you see, here's the problem. You don't know the history of psychiatry. I do. All it does is mask the problem, Matt. And if you understand the history of it, it masks the problem. That's what it does. That's all it does. You're not getting to the reason why. There is no such thing as a chemical imbalance.
So postpartum depression to you is Matt, kind of a little psychological gobbledygook?
No, I did not say that.
I'm just asking, what would you call it?
Matt, that is, now you're talking about two different things.
But that's what she went on the antidepressant for.
But what happens, the antidepressant, all it does is mask the problem. There's ways of vitamins and through exercise and various things. I'm not saying that that isn't real. That's not what I'm saying. That's an alteration of what I'm saying. I'm saying that drugs aren't the answer. That these drugs are very dangerous. They're mind-altering drugs. And there are ways of doing it without that, so that we don't end up in a brave new world.
Do you examine the possibility that these things do work for some people? That yes, there are abuses. And yes, maybe they've gone too far in certain areas. Maybe there are too many kids on Ritalin. Maybe electric shock
is... kids on Ritalin? Matt.
I'm just saying. But aren't there examples where it works?
Matt, you don't even... you're glib. You don't even know what Ritalin is. If you start talking about chemical imbalance, you have to evaluate and read the research papers on how they came up with these theories, Matt. Okay? That's what I've done. And you go and you say, where's the medical test? Where's the blood test that says how much Ritalin you're supposed to get? It's very impressive to listen to you because clearly you've done the homework and you know the subject. And you should. And you should do that also because just knowing people who are on Ritalin isn't enough. You should be a little bit more responsible in knowing.
I'm
really
not prescribing Ritalin, Tom, and I'm not asking anyone else to do it.
You're saying,
some people who seem to have been helped by it.
This is a very important issue.
I couldn't agree more.
You know what? And you're here on the Today Show.
Right.
And to talk about it in a way of saying, well, isn't it okay and being reasonable about it when you don't know, and I do. I think that you should be a little bit more responsible in knowing what it is. Because you communicate to people.
But you're all in the end all.
Matt, but here's the point. What is an ideal scene in life? Okay? Ideal scene is someone not having to take antipsychotic drugs.
I would agree.
Okay, so now you look at it and you go, okay, a departure from that ideal scene is someone taking drugs.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and then you go, okay, what is the theory and the science behind that that justifies that? Look, if I want to know something, I go and find out. Because I don't talk about things that I don't understand. I'll say, you know what? I'm not so sure about that. I'll go find more information about it so I can come to an opinion based on the information that I have.
You're so passionate about it.
And I'm passionate about learning. I'm passionate about life, Matt.
And it really feels like there's a lot of crossover between psychoanalysis and Scientology. And especially it seems like Hubbard in the movie, or I should say Powers, basically takes all of this kind of hypnosis research, regression kind of thing, which is really completely Freudian, and makes it his own, sometimes quite literally, like sitting at the typewriter and asking, you know, you're a psychology student, what about this? Tell me some ideas. You know, it felt like he was really kind of taking what he wanted from psychology and then distancing himself completely
from
it.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, when you look at Dianetics, as I said, I picked up a used copy of Dianetics years ago for about 50 cents at a used bookstore and read it just out of pure curiosity. And when you read it, it's very much in the mode of what I would call applied psychology or everyday psychology. I mean, like sort of like how you and I interact, how we interact in public, what we understand about ourselves and what makes us feel good or how we can work through things. There's a lot of really basic things within Dianetics when you read it that make sense, you know, if you've had a psychology class. Where it kind of goes off the rails later is, and a lot of this is covered in Going Clear in Lawrence Wright's book, is that he had done Dianetics, and I think they go into this a little bit within the film The Prophet as well, is that he had written the book and then had created these things, and he was trying to get people to do auditing and things like that and go, look, you know, this is scientific. This is, you know, this is fact. We can use this. This is usable for what we're trying to do. And this should be given over to humanity kind of thing. And you guys should accept this in the American Psychological Association, I believe it was. And they looked at it and said, this is junk. Like, it's half true, half bullshit. And we can't go in and, you know, redo these tests and prove that this stuff works. So therefore it's not science, it's pseudoscience. And because of that, we give it the thumbs down and nobody should be following your book and all of this. And there was this back and forth between the psychological establishment and L. Ron Hubbard after Dianetics came out in the 1950s. And I think that's really where the core of it is. And there was discussions within Lawrence Wright's book that from time to time, Hubbard was trying to infiltrate the psychological establishment and either discredit them or take them over or create sort of a parallel group that would be able to go in and give advice to the public under the guise that they were from this group, but they really weren't. And that's what led to a lot of this negative back and forth between the psychological establishment and L. Ron Hubbard.
You don't know the history of psychiatry. I do.
Scientology is more of an alternative to psychology than a religion.
Now, what is auditing? We should probably explain
auditing
that.
Auditing within Dianetics, and you also read about it in Going Clear, is that the whole idea is that you have these things called engrams. And engrams are supposedly these bad memories that are in your head. Now, according to L. Ron Hubbard, and this has never been proved in a scientific fact, he believed that from the moment you were born, even before you were born, there's basically a tape recorder in your head, and that everything that happens to you is recorded. You remember everything that's in there. It may be stuck in your subconscious state, and you may not be able to access it directly, but every single thing that's ever happened to you is in there. So every negative emotion that you've ever had, every time that someone cut you off in traffic, whatever, has been stored in your brain.
And so we just try to analyze your personality. And if it seems like you need some help, then you can have audit counseling for a nominal fee.
Well, that sounds pretty reasonable. Okay.
Through auditing, through basically talking to someone, you can reach in and pull these things out and eventually remove them. And that's the idea, that through counseling, the auditing sessions, through various stages within Scientology, through taking various courses, you can eventually hit a certain stage, and that's when you're clear, meaning that all of this negative emotion and memory that's been stored into your subconscious has been removed. And that is the ultimate goal, is that you want to purge all of this stuff out of you. Now, we all know through things like Skinner and that it is true that bad things that happen to you can lead to PTSD, it can lead to traumas, it can force you to act a little bit differently in public and things like that. So some of it is based in truth, but the idea that you can possibly pull all this stuff out may not necessarily be the case. And within the testing community, within the scientific community, they just didn't see that this was of any value. And the same thing also with the e-meters. And the e-meters are basically these machines where you hold on to, like, they look like two cans, and you hold on to them. And based on, supposedly, you give off this energy, and it shows sort of how much – it's sort of like a lie detector, I guess. And based on those readings, the person who's the auditor who's working with you is supposed to be able to tell if you've been able to purge these things. Well, the federal government has forced them to put stickers on the machine saying that they don't – that there's no real scientific value in these things, and may not even be of any value. And we don't necessarily know if, you know, they haven't been able to prove it scientifically.
The thing that really got me about the prophet was just how much of a charlatan L. Conrad Powers is portrayed as being. The whole idea where if he wants something, he's going to do anything to get it, where he imitates a doctor, where he, you know, is kind of setting up these, like, almost like tent revival kind of things. And it's just kind of crazy how illegal some of the things are. I want to talk a little bit about The Master, because you're right, there are so many parallels between these two movies. I finally watched The Master last night for the first time, and I'm still very perplexed by it. It kind of feels like, it almost felt like an adaptation of a book where if you had read the book, the movie would make a lot of sense, but having not read the book, the movie didn't make a whole lot of sense to me. What's your take on the film?
I think that if you come into it with some level of Scientology and some level of L. Ron Hubbard and all of this stuff. Now, I had read Going Clear after, but I had read Dianetics before. And I had also, as I said, gone through the tests and had read a lot about Scientology. So I knew some of this stuff before I went into the film. I think that you can enjoy it on a deeper level and understand it on a deeper level if you have that background. If you don't have that background, I think that some of the things that are in The Master can become distracting, and it can throw you off. You can just be like, I don't know what's going on. I'm checking out. And ultimately, and we had this conversation on Facebook last night after you watched it, where you're like, I hope Rob can explain The Master to me, is to me, really, the film is not even about Scientology. It happens to bring in aspects of L. Ron Hubbard's story. But ultimately, what I see the story as sort of hinges on three ideas. One is the Freddie Quell character, played by Joaquin Phoenix, is part of this. He's part of the World War II generation that we never talk about in America. To us, World War II ended. Everyone came home. They were perfectly fine. They got their house and their white picket fence and their two kids in the suburbs, and everything was great. It was Ozzie and Harriet. It was Leave It to Beaver. That's bullshit. We know that's not true. Because out of World War II, we ended up with the Beat Generation. And that was sort of, in a way, related back to the traumas of those who came back from World War II and could fit back into this molded society in the image that they wanted to portray in the 1950s. So I would say that the Freddie Quell character is a very much a lost person, and he's very animalistic in his manner and can't really relate in the society in which he came back to. It's not to say that before he went to war he was any better. I wouldn't believe that from Joaquin Phoenix's character. We get the feeling he was probably messed up before he got there. But when he comes back, he ends up meeting Lancaster Dodd, who's played by Philip Seymour Hoffman, the L. Ron Hubbard character, and goes along with him and really gets involved into being a true believer into him in many ways. And to me, I think the second theme that we see within the Master is the pain of a true believer who finds out that the person who is giving him the thing that he believes that he needs is lying to him and is not truthful in either his representation as a person or in the representation of the help that he's trying to give him, meaning the cause, which is the Scientology-like, Dianetics-like group that's created within the film. And I think we can see that when we look at people who have been taken advantage of by televangelists or various other religious leaders. And then I think the third and probably most basic element of the Master to me thematically is about a romance between two men that can never be fully expressed. They can't say it to each other. You know, it's the whole thing. Two men can love each other by beating the hell out of each other, not by f***ing. It just isn't going to happen. And especially within that context of that time, you really get the feeling that both of them have this sort of hidden thing going on. There's this subtext between the two. And I would even say it's almost father and son too, which isn't that unusual when you consider Paul Thomas Anderson's scope of his work. He does have a lot of father and son aspects throughout his films as well. So I think that's another layer in there as well.
It seemed like there was some father-son stuff going on between Hoffman's character and the Jesse Plemons character. And I have to say it was brilliant to cast Jesse Plemons as Philip Seymour Hoffman's son, just because the two look so similar. I mean, he literally looks like a younger version of Philip Seymour Hoffman just in his day-to-day life. And then they kind of dropped it after a bit. It seemed like once they arrested Lancaster Dodd character, that I didn't really see too much of his son, Val, after that, which was kind of weird. And then there was this whole thing of, like, there was a lot of family stuff in there. There was, like, yeah, one of the most unusual hand job scenes I've ever seen with Amy Adams' character, and that was just bizarre. There were just so many strange things going on in the movie where I just was scratching my head so often. It felt like we kind of joined this movie in progress, you know, like this had been playing for a while on television and I flipped it on and I had no idea what was happening. And it felt like that was happening all the time to me. Like it was this constant, like, you know, the scene would change and I'd be like, okay, now what's happening here? How long has it been since the last thing that we saw? It just felt very disjointed.
It is not my favorite of Paul Thomas Anderson. I still believe that There Will Be Blood will be the film that 20 years from now will make Sight and Sound's like 10 best, you know, ever list. But I think that The Master is interesting for its ideas. I don't think it works in total.
We're sorry, but we've run out of time. Be sure to listen to the rest of this episode at jackaloperadio.com in the Projection Booth archives. And be sure to leave your feedback at projection-booth.com. Stay classy.